This is an ABC podcast.
Betcha there's plenty of gold under there. Obviously, as long as it doesn't interfere and have any structural problems or with the infrastructure of the town, I can't see any problem. My only concern is any blasting that's obviously going to get done could have an issue with the town. And
the gold beneath their feet, we head to the Gold Rush town, where the search for new deposits is heading beneath the town itself, and learning the nearly extinct language of your ancestors.
Oh, absolutely amazing feeling. Like, I just can't even explain it, to see that our culture's been acknowledged and loved and the whole school was singing it, like we all come together as one to do it.
A primary school in eastern Victoria is teaching its students songs in a nearly lost Indigenous language. I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. But firstly, tonight we head to New South Wales, where a three-day youth summit organised by the United Nations Children's Fund has brought together 100 young people from across the state who are affected by the drought. It's being held at Lake Macquarie on the New South Wales Central Coast, and it's the first event of its kind, giving kids the chance to add their voice to the drought conversation. Reporter Madeline Lewis was there for the opening day.
Patrick Bloomfield, and I'm 16.
Tell me where you're from.
Corona, so it's a little village about half an hour west of Corindai on the Liverpool Plains. We're on a beef property, beef cattle property, so 2,000 acres there, and there's also crop, mixed cropping and things out there too, yep.
And what's it look like out there at the moment?
Yeah, pretty desperate. You know, it's just dirt and that, really.
How has the drought made you feel?
I think it's affected me in a couple of ways, but I think emotionally a lot, with stress and things like that as well, you know, because I'm going through year 10 at the moment, so schoolwork as well as on top of all the stresses of farm work and that.
Hayley Doohan and I'm 17. So I'm from a small country town, Finley, right down in the southern Riverina, right near the border, and we were a dairy farm.
Tell me about that decision that was made earlier this year. You mentioned that the plants closed in March.
It was a really hard decision for my parents to make because we moved to this area for the irrigation system because we were from North Queensland originally, and so we came there for the water security, and to switch the plant off was one that was made with the mind of our family.
These are just a couple of voices at the UNICEF New South Wales Youth Summit on Living with Drought. There's about 100 young people aged 14 to 24 at Lake Macquarie for 3 days of talks on how the drought is impacting them. Like many, 20-year-old Jerry Carter from Ningen doesn't believe they're being listened to and says it's about time the light is shone on them.
At this stage, it's a lack of understanding. That's, for some reason, there isn't any understanding. There's no connection between the people living it and the authorities and high government actually doing things. The ones who are saying that they're here for people, that they're here for us, they're doing this, they're doing that, but they never meet with us.
He's not alone in his thoughts. Teenagers watching their families deal with the drought just want to help.
My name's Paris Crouch. I am 18 and I am from Bathurst in New South Wales. It really hurts me because I've seen a lot of farmers lose everything to this drought. They have lost their livestock and even some have lost their lives. So being from that area, seeing that happen, it's devastating to see.
Will Thomas, I'm 15. I'm originally from Tullamore. It's always changing. Like, you might start the term off and it might look all right because you might have a couple of mills and then you go back at the end and it's all changed and it's back to dry again.
How does it make you feel to see the drought continue on and each time you go home to visit your property?
Oh, it's a bit frustrating, really, because it's been going on for a long time now and it's about time it broke.
The government says it is listening and the answers are going to come from a whole-of-community approach. New South Wales Minister for Mental Health, Regional Youth and Women, Bronnie Taylor.
Look, I think they're actually coming here to look at solutions, and I think it's really important that, yes, government's part of it, but communities are part of it. This is something that needs to be driven by everyone, and I think that the best solutions are local solutions. So I'll be really looking forward to hearing what these young people have to say with their ideas and their options about where they think we can be doing better. I was just speaking to a young bloke from Orange. He wants to look at population growth and what's happening in his area. That's really important. We know it's important. We know we want to keep our young people in their areas. So I'm excited to hear what they've got to say.
The three-day summit was born after UNICEF produced a report earlier this year called In Their Own Words on how children and young people are impacted by drought. What it revealed was that there's not a lot of understanding on this, not enough stories told from their perspective. Chair of UNICEF Australia, Anne Sherry, agrees.
They were very vocal about the absence of consultation with them, as though they don't exist and they don't have a different experience. It also picked up their mental health issues as well, and given tomorrow's World Mental Health Day, this is really timely to get them to talk about the way it's impacting them. But again, they were very focused on solutions. They've got ideas, they want their ideas brought and put on the table, and they want the government to listen to their ideas as well.
So the aim of this event is to bring young people together and develop a community, take what they say and work it into ideas and solutions, and offer some time out, a mental health break, away from the farm and from school. While there is fun to be had and new friends to be made, the conversations are serious and will help form a final report from UNICEF that will be submitted to the government. 21-year-old Leanna Mills from Dubbo works for the Rural Financial Counselling Service and understands just how important the next few days are.
I think the biggest thing that I'm hoping to get out is some recognition of how the drought is affecting not only the farmers and the people directly on the land, but, you know, their kids and some younger people, and how that's affecting our access into things like mental health facilities, how it's affecting, you know, even things as basic as schooling and, like, a lack of education in the general public about what the drought is.
One thing's for sure, overall, young people have the same message for decision makers, and it's loud and clear.
You need to fix it, because the way that you're running things at the moment isn't working. It's very one-field-minded. It's not helping everyone. It's for one particular group, and you need to do something now, because agriculture in Australia is declining, and without it, what's Australia going to do?
Madeline Lewis with that story from Lake Macquarie in New South Wales.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And staying with the effects of the drought on many in regional Australia, Struggle Street is an SBS documentary series focusing on experiences of poverty and disadvantage in Australia. The past two seasons have been filmed in Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney, and now they're back for season three, airing tonight at 8:30 on SBS. This time, it's the stories of regional Australians doing it tough that will appear on your television screen.
Yeah, it's been the perfect storm. Low milk prices, low rainfall, and this year the heat's been really high.
I don't think there's a future here. I believe there's only about 55 days left of feed and water that we have available to us.
That's Riverina dairy farmers Barry and Rosie Warburton, who feature in season three of Struggle Street on SBS. David Galloway is the director of programs at Loon Media and executive producer of Struggle Street, and he joins us on Australia Wide. David, why did you feel it was important to take the show into regional Australia?
Well, Alex, 30% of Australians live outside of our capital cities. They, you know, form a huge part of our Australia's population. The first two series of Struggle Street, as you mentioned, we focused on disadvantage in the outer areas of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. But I think there was a crying need for the stories of people in rural and regional Australia to be heard.
And Eastern Australia is gripped in drought at the moment. Can you give us a sense of the issues you encountered in the regions that previous seasons may not have covered?
Well, there are some unique issues and some unique challenges facing people, as we know, in the bush. When we started looking at this series about 18 months ago, the drought was starting to take hold, but, you know, we had really no idea just how bad things were going to get, and of course still are, in parts of the Riverina area where we filmed. But that's just one of the issues that we're looking at in this series, because there are others unique to people living in the bush: access to healthcare, unemployment, the death of small country towns, which I think is a big issue in areas around Wagga, where we base the production this time around.
And why was it the Riverina that you decided upon? What was it about that area?
Alex, we looked at various parts of Australia in the research and the pre-production for the series, areas of South Australia, north of Adelaide. We also looked at northern New South Wales. But the Riverina, for various reasons, kind of encapsulated a whole range of experiences and issues facing people in rural Australia. within an hour's drive of Wagga, we've got, you know, dairy farming, we've got small country towns. We could also find stories of people dealing with healthcare issues in the bush. And it's also, you know, it's a big regional city and a good base for the production team to be housed.
Tell us more about the story of Barry and Rosie Warburton, who we heard earlier. What are they going through?
Barry and Rosie are a wonderful couple. Barry's 54. He's a dairy farmer and has been all his life. He and Rosie have a property in Deniliquin in the southwest Riverina. And Barry's, I think, a fourth or fifth generation dairy farmer. They've been doing it a long time. And they're recent parents as well. They've got a two-year-old daughter, Annabella, and five-year-old Lincoln. But the issues that they're facing at the moment, as you heard in that grab that you played earlier, Alex, it's a perfect storm. You know, they've got low milk prices. The drought is really taking hold there. And, of course, there are increased costs for things like feed and electricity. So they are absolutely facing
I am the new homeless, as are many other well-educated people.
On ABC Australia Wide.
And from a production side, how do you get people to let you into their homes and tell what can be very difficult stories to divulge, to open up about these things that are often kept to themselves?
Well, they are difficult stories, Alex. And what we've done and have done in previous series is spend a lot of time in those areas before we start filming, just to get, you know, an understanding and a feel of the issues that are affecting people and people in those communities. We spend a lot of time talking to them, talking to people in welfare organisations and charitable organisations in those places. And, you know, it's a long process of relationship building and trust. And when they realise that we're not a fly-in, fly-out news organisation, that we want to spend, you know, a long time documenting their stories, they let us into their lives, and we're very grateful for that.
It's been 4 years since you began filming Struggle Street. What's changed for Australia as far as rates of impoverishment is concerned?
Well, I think they've actually gotten worse, Alex. When we started this series back in 2014-15, I think there were just about 2.9 million Australians living below the poverty line. Today, that's over 3 million people. And the rate of poverty in the bush is even worse. The other thing that's really important is the gap between the rich and poor. And I think the OECD latest figures show that that gap in Australia is actually widening. So I think the great irony is after 26, 27 years of economic growth in this country, the people at the bottom end are stuck in the bottom end, that they're not benefiting from, you know, a lot of wealth that's been generated in Australia.
So what then do you hope comes from this season of Struggle Street and from the project generally?
I think it's about shining a light on the stories of people who don't really have a voice. Certainly people in the country, and this is what we hear from people we've worked with in the past year and a half, are really struggling to be heard. You know, we have TV newsrooms and local newspapers closing down in various parts of particularly the area where we were filming. And so it's becoming harder and harder for them to get their issues raised. For people, particularly in the city, where, again, there's not a lot of focus in the media on the experience of the bush, for people in the city to get a greater understanding of the difficulties that people in regional Australia are facing.
David Galloway, we really appreciate you speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks very much, Alex.
And you can see Series 3 of Struggle Street, focusing on regional Australia, on SBS TV tonight at 8:30.
ABC Australia Wide.
I've had a good life, but I am the new homeless, as are many other well-educated people.
On ABC Radio.
To the WA Goldfields, residents of one of Australia's most famous gold rush towns are divided over plans to explore for the precious metal beneath their streets. This is off the back of record prices for gold, which have injected new life into Coolgardie. Jared Lucas is just down the road. He's in Kalgoorlie and he's been following this story. Jared, where is this search for gold? Is it quite literally beneath the homes and buildings of Coolgardie?
Yeah, well, people that aren't familiar with the region need to know that I guess it's back to 1892 that gold was found in this town, and it sparked one of the biggest gold rushes the world's ever seen. So basically, the town site was built right next to where gold was found back in those days. So geologists tell me that the most logical place to look for a new gold mine is next door to an old one. So I guess logic would suggest that there could be something hiding underneath the town. Now, where we're at with this exploration effort here is there are three separate prospecting license applications currently before the Lands Minister. That is the Rita Saffioti here in Western Australia. Now, these applications cover about 195 hectares of the Coolgardie town site. So we're talking quite a considerable amount of the town. It's their industrial area, it's their main street, it's private housing, quite a significant portion of land. Now, before any exploration drilling can be done, the Lands Minister will have to sign off. So we're not at the stage of trying to hit pay dirt just yet, but it's an interesting part of the process to go hunting for gold.
So who has applied for these prospecting licences?
So two of the licences have been applied for, a company by the name of Focus Minerals. Now, they've been a gold miner in Coolgardie for many years. They actually closed their operations in 2013 when the gold price crashed, but they've been progressing this application for over 12 months now, and there's another private company as well.
So you've been gauging opinion on this from a whole host of people. What's the reality of mining within the town site of Coolgardie?
Well, yeah, I did speak to the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. That's a mining industry lobby group, and their chief executive, Warren Pierce, basically tells me you could look for gold virtually anywhere, but it's whether or not you've got a realistic chance of getting a project up.
You can go about exploring and mining or make an application to do that pretty much anywhere. The reality of it, though, is that depending on where you put your application, it's going to depend whether you've got any reasonable prospect of actually being able to go through the activity or developing it if it actually bears some fruit. But there's certainly a wide range of thinking that suggests that there are substantial deposits underneath these towns that have been built around mining booms, right next door. And so there's been that sort of conjecture about Mount Isa in Queensland, certainly about Kalgoorlie for a long period of time. But you've got to wonder whether or not anyone's ever going to be able to actually develop that, short of being able to sort of underground mine their way towards the deposit.
That's Warren Pierce there from AMEC. And what's been the reaction from the town itself, from those who live in Coolgardie and call it home, Jared?
Yeah, I went door knocking down one street where residents are right on the borderline of where drilling's been proposed. And basically, one lady who didn't want to give me a name told me that she doesn't want mining right on her doorstep. She believes it's already close enough to the town. I spoke to another man, a retired underground miner by the name of Dave McNally. He tells me that he's all for it.
Well, my thoughts is they can go ahead and drill along here. I think everybody would like to know what's under half these streets around here. As long as they put restrictions on the mining company in regards to what they're going to do, how they're going to drill, and they come and ask the residents, which they haven't done. This is the first time we've really heard of this proposal.
Coolgardie is obviously built on gold mining, so it's no secret there's probably some gold under there. Do you suspect that as a former miner?
Yeah, I know there's some gold under here. I know. I've done some panning off down the back and there's a bit of gold here and there.
That's Coolgardie resident Dave McNally there. So who has the final say, Jared?
Yeah, so we'll be waiting on the WA Minister for Lands, Rita Saffiotti's decision. She has the final say-so on whether or not exploration can go ahead. Developing a mine is a long, long way down in the future. They've obviously got to find something worth mining out as well. But I guess the crux of this story is that gold prices being near record levels, going past $2,000 an ounce for the first time this year in Aussie dollar terms. I mean, that's really put a rocket under a lot of gold miners and explorers, and they're getting pretty innovative. They're looking for it everywhere, under every rock.
Jared Lucas, thank you so much for bringing us this story. Really appreciate your time here on Australia Wide.
Thank you.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I don't want to put a killjoy on their fabulous family tradition, but
it was just mayhem and chaos.
The majority of them are still buying their trees, regardless of the snake.
So this is the first time we've opened the slide this summer.
On ABC Radio.
Yes, you are listening to Australia Wide with me, Alex Hyman, in for Sinead Mangan for this week. A rural primary school in eastern Victoria has recorded a song in the local Aboriginal language. At Torloo Primary, the whole school is learning Gunai Kurnai, According to the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies, about 90% of Australia's Indigenous languages are endangered, and only 13 traditional Indigenous languages are still spoken by children. Reporter Mim Cook went along to the school and met with some students, parents and teachers to learn about the songwriting process.
My nan's mum, she spoke Gunaikin language, but the white people, when they came, they said that she wasn't allowed to speak Gunaikin language anymore, or else all 9 of her kids were taken away from her. So it was like, if she spoke Gunaikin language, it was going to be sort of like the stolen generation for my nan, because they weren't allowed to speak Gunaikin language.
So was the language lost? Was some of the language lost?
My nan says it's been lost for 100 years, and that's why we don't speak it no more, because it's been lost. And
do you think you can find your language again?
Yes, I reckon it's possible.
This is James. He's in grade 6 at Tuluam Primary in East Gippsland. The whole school has started learning his Indigenous Australian language, Gunaikurnai. All the kids at Tuluam Primary have learnt a song in Gunaikurnai.
James, what did you think about learning your culture in your own school?
Made me feel proud and everyone was included.
This is Leilani and then Amelia. They're in grade 6 at Tuluam Primary and have loved learning to speak and sing in their language.
Did you learn more about your own culture?
Uh-huh. I've learnt heaps of words now.
Can you tell us something?
Well, this is one. It's wok wok, means earth, ground, or soil.
Well, it's important to me because we were learning our culture and it's actually fun.
I'm Sasha Bryant and I'm a parent. I'm a Gunaikurnai woman. They just felt real proud of their culture.
Yeah.
My oldest son's usually quite shy, but he was really like embracing it and getting out there, and he was singing and dancing, and like he just loved it. He'd bring it home. They were doing their dig stuff more, so it was more like the culture come more to us, which was good.
Did you feel more of a connection between home and school?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like with having the, because we do dig and stuff at home and stuff, we've never had anything in the school that represents our culture. So I think the boys just felt so excited because they had so much knowledge and they could sing it. And I don't know, like it was just a good, like it was an amazing feeling because my nans came here, my dad came here, I came here to Tuluam, and now my kids are coming here. And this is the first time that we've had Gunaikurnai language being brought into the school. So it was just absolutely amazing feeling. Like I just can't even explain it, to see that our culture's been acknowledged and loved and the whole school was singing it, like we all come together as one to do it. So it was just I just can't even explain how good it felt.
Kira Hughes, principal at Tuluam Primary School.
And can you tell me about the project, please?
Yeah, sure. Look, Mim, connecting to our local Koori community is vitally important in creating culturally inclusive schools. This year, being the UNESCO Year of Indigenous Language, we embarked on a First Language program aimed at promoting First Languages. Having Gunaikurnai language reverberating through our school was really moving.
So you've put together a song, and the children have learnt a song at this school.
Absolutely. So the song got transcribed by Lynn Solomon Dent into Gunaikurnai language, and then all the children were taught the song and we've put it together.
This is Leilani again.
We're all celebrating together as one. When we get old and we become elders, we might pass it down to our children. It might be passed down all the time, and I think it's going to be possible because it might happen like in the 3000s or something.
Mim Mim Cook with that story from Tuluam Primary in eastern Victoria. And that's the program for this Wednesday. Remember, you can visit the Australia-wide website to listen back to this and previous programs. And you can always subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast service. Just search for Australia-wide. I'll be back again tomorrow with more from the Australia-wide team. I'm Alex Hyman. Have a great evening.
This is an ABC podcast.